I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. For people who like their buzzwords parsed and picked apart, this hour is for you on neoliberalism, a loose notion that could be used to link Dubai and Davos and Detroit in conversation anyway. It's not a proper policy word, not in the paper much, almost never debated, but it has come to feel like the operating system, the undercarriage of our globalized economy, our gadgets, our schools, our culture, our dating games as well, our music, our mindset, and of course, our language. You're living in neoliberal land when you hear Republicans like Paul Ryan talk freedom and choice.
This has been the crown jewel of conservative healthcare reform, to equalize the tax treatment of healthcare so that we can have a vibrant individual market, to have a free market in healthcare, to bring consumers into the market, to put pressure on providers.
Or when Democrats, say Cory Booker, do the same thing.
The disparities in income in America are not because of some greedy capitalist. No, it's because of a failing education system. And if you're buying America right now, you know the crisis. We need venture capital.
You're in the neoliberal zone when you hear people wanting to privatize parking meters or prisons, even space programs.
Major setback for SpaceX. This is the commercial space company that NASA has turned to, but this particular rocket was on a Facebook mission.
You're hearing neoliberalism when people talk about smartphones, smart drugs, smart condoms, pretty much anything with smart in its name.
With the technology in our pockets today and a little smart regulation, we can reclaim our cities. Starting today.
You're in neoliberal land if everything you see can be hacked or disrupted in the name of higher speed or lower price, when everyone on your Twitter feed is talking about the same celebrity.
Beyonce just released an album. All my coworkers are going to be talking about Beyonce. They're going to be thinking about Beyonce. They're going to be tweeting about Beyonce. They're going to know that Beyonce happened. Now I know too, because I saw it on Twitter, and it makes me smarter. So this is what's happening.
When every citation in culture waits to be rated and explained.
You know, Rap Genius, we started it as a platform to annotate song lyrics. And now we've moved on to all of text and all of human culture. We're annotating the Bible, Shakespeare, Goethe, you name it.
The many faces of neoliberalism this hour. It's an era we're not quite out of. It's a look and a lifestyle by now. A culture of striving to some, to others. It's a religion of money and the people who make it. The Church of Silicon Valley. For starters, a little history with Corey Robin, beloved blogger and historian at the City University of New York, as he's going to tell you. Neoliberalism surfaced 40 years ago as a political strategy, a bit of a switch on Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. In the 30s, a lot of Republicans had fought back for free markets against the welfare state. By the 1970s, after World War and recovery, up-and-coming Democrats I covered as a reporter were adapting some old themes experimentally.
Beginning in roughly in the 1970s, there's a reconsideration within the Democratic Party of the standard New Deal tenets. In particular, the commitment to the labor movement and labor unions, the commitment to the state intervening in the economy and redistributing resources on behalf of people who aren't wealthy. And neoliberals are really at the center of this. There's figures like a young Stephen Breyer, who is a staffer in the Senate, starts pushing for deregulation of transportation and of banking. And it comes together under Jimmy Carter.
We deregulated the airlines. We deregulated the trucking industry. We deregulated financial institutions. We decontrolled oil and natural gas prices and needless and burdensome federal regulations, which benefit nobody and which harm all of us.
People forget, because he's been so loathed by the Republican Party for so many years, and has been reclaimed by the Democrats, but he was really disliked by many Democrats because he was thought to be an untrustworthy liberal. He was the first neoliberal, you might say, in the White House, who successfully pushed for deregulation, who really broke with the unions over a couple of key issues, so much so that it provoked a big challenge from Teddy Kennedy in 1980, a failed challenge. So Jimmy Carter was really, as I say, the first neoliberal. But he was such a controversial, divisive figure within the Democratic Party that I would say it really was not until Bill Clinton that the Democratic Party embraced neoliberalism, you know, pretty much completely. And that's why you see, you know, the final destruction of welfare under someone like Bill Clinton, but that was the final thing that had happened. Much of the work had begun earlier.
Hold it there before you let Jimmy Carter go. I think I was present at the creation, the moment Jimmy Carter running in the Pennsylvania primary. I was covering for the New York Times. He was meeting with the Mine Workers Union. They wanted black lung coverage. And he told them, sorry, no. And the famous line was, they chose to be miners. Meaning that's the hazard of the job. You're out of luck. And he was running, of course, in that 76 campaign against the absent liberals, Hubert Humphrey and Ted Kennedy. And he got away with it. He got away with saying no to a labor union. And the rest unfolded from that moment, I think.
And people also forget this, but in the late part of that campaign, the labor unions were very nervous about Carter. So there was a Stop Carter movement, which failed. And they looked to a lot of the more liberal senators. But it was really the moment, I think, where the party took that turn. And in some ways, it never really looked back.
Milestones along the way. I wonder how people can spot neoliberalism on the street in their lives.
In terms of a milestone, I think there's a key document. There was an article by Charles Peters in the Washington Monthly called A Neoliberal's Manifesto. And it sets out many of the basic arguments for the movement. And what's interesting about it is how resonant it, I think, continues to be. I think people today would still recognize it as a distinctive type. Very suspicious, as I said, of unions and of big government. But what's also interesting is that it claims to care about the truly downtrodden, the truly poor. And what Peter says is that unions and big government favor middle-class people. They don't actually favor the truly poor. And what we need to have are leaner government programs that are targeted to the people who truly need them. And I think right there, you see some of the debate we saw this past year between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary campaign. Sanders famously called for free college for everybody. And Hillary Clinton's response and many people around her, including the current head of the DNC, Tom Perez, was, well, why should somebody who's wealthy, someone like Donald Trump, get a benefit like that? Benefits like that should only be for the people who really need it. The hallmark of, or one of the hallmarks of neoliberalism that we are still stuck with today is this kind of means-tested notion of social programs rather than Social Security, which goes to everybody. And everybody benefits from it, or Medicare, which everybody at a certain age benefits from. And because everybody benefits from these programs, they're very hard to get rid of. Instead, you have this style of thinking that says, no, government programs that are redistributive in some way should really be targeted to people at the bottom. And the problem with that thinking, I mean, there's many problems with it, but the key one is that it's politically not sustainable over the long haul, as we saw with welfare. Welfare was a means-tested, targeted program, and it became the easiest thing in the end to get rid of. Social Security, most Republicans wouldn't even touch it today because it's such a popular program. So when you ask what are some of the touchstones or the ways of thinking or seeing neoliberalism, I think that's a key one.
And then the people, Gary Hart, Paul Tsongas, Michael Dukakis, Joe Biden in some degree, and finally, the triumphant Bill Clinton. What about them? Who were they?
So they were all younger Democrats in the 70s. Many of them had been active in the anti-war movement. Gary Hart had been George McGovern's campaign advisor in 1972. And they were a generation that was more suspicious of the state, in part for some very good reasons. You know, for them, the state meant the Vietnam War and the national security state. But they extended it into the realm of the economy. And they tended to see the disasters of Vietnam writ large in the disasters of the Great Society, let's say, or of the New Deal. That is, these were big government planners in their minds, you know, thinking they could reconstruct the world through government rather than letting markets, which are much more nimble and much more responsive to everybody's particular concerns. So there was a notion that markets could really be a way of ordering society that allowed for widespread prosperity and distribution, but also more individualized freedom and responsiveness. People like Gary Hart, as you said, Bruce Babbitt was another, James Fallows, who was Gary Hart's speechwriter, is still a journalist today. Robert Reich, I'd say, was another big neoliberal, although he's had quite a turn in recent years. all of them, I think, were really drawn to this idea of the nimbleness of markets and the flexibility of markets, and that government should really try to stay out as much as possible. And what's interesting about these sorts of arguments is they were very familiar on the right. If you read Milton Friedman, or if you read someone like Friedrich Hayek, who was the European version of Milton Friedman, these neoliberals were, whether consciously or not, cribbing arguments that had been the stock and trade of the free market right since the 1930s.
Corey, Robin, look around you. How do you know, and what should people see as evidence that they're living in a sort of operating system called neoliberalism?
So I teach at City University of New York. It used to be the crown jewel, the pride and joy of New York City and New York State. It was free up until the mid-1970s, and it educated everybody across the working class, the middle class, African-American, Latino, white. And since the 1970s, there's been a real assault. I'm just giving you one example that's very visceral and familiar to me, but we can multiply these. Since the 1970s, there's been a real assault on this civic institution that was there for everybody and that was free. So now students are paying somewhere along the lines of $6,500 to $7,000, which if, you know, up in Cambridge and you're thinking about universities there, may not seem like a lot, but we have a lot of poor students. We have a lot of undocumented students. So it's a lot of money. And the quality of the education has just really gone down. The buildings are falling apart. The salaries you can pay professors to recruit people and staff, all of that has gone down. So this, to me, is emblematic of neoliberalism, which is a real hostility and suspicion of what the state can do. So you end up defunding it. And then lo and behold, once you defund it and deprive it of resources, you turn around and you say, well, it's terrible. It's a crappy institution. I mean, and this is what state institutions are all about. So to me, that's neoliberalism in a nutshell.
That was Corey Robin, and the last you'll hear this hour on neoliberalism as mere politics. Coming up, neoliberalism is also airport design, it's media, it's city planning, it's a brand of feminism that doesn't quite fully disclose itself, and it may shed some light on your love life. This is Open Source. Testing this cultural alloy called neoliberalism. I think of it sometimes as what capitalism is doing to humanism, or what wealth has done to self-respecting poverty. Because we want to recognize it on the street, we asked the postmodern urbanist Greg Lindsay to point us straight at it. He wrote the book Aerotropolis, The Way We'll Live Next, and he thinks hard on his website about, say, New York after the coming flood, or American cities in the age of Uber.
I'm reminded of that line from The Matrix, that the Matrix is something we cannot see or hear or touch. And that's so obviously not true of neoliberalism. We see things every day that are delivered to us by massive global systems that are designed to bring flowers or sushi or our iPhones to us. You know, they're the product of 40 years of global supply chain parsing and outsourcing and the construction of airports and warehouses and factories to deliver it all either overnight or the same day. So, you know, walking down a New York City street, for example, you know, if you look at a bodega with the flowers that are being delivered on the sidewalk, you can bend down and you can read the label on the box to see whether it's come from Colombia, where there's giant farms where workers basically are covered in pesticides, or you can see whether they come via the Alsmeer auctions in the Netherlands, where, you know, millions and millions of flowers are auctioned daily before being flown around the world from farms in Kenya or Israel. Or, you know, every time you handle your phone in your pocket, I mean, that's the result of a huge global supply chain that reaches its apex at a single factory in Zhengzhou, China, before they're flown around the world. Or, you know, anytime you eat sushi, if you're a sushi aficionado, I mean, bluefin has been fished almost to extinction because of it acquired its taste when Japan started importing it back from the United States in 1959, made possible by refrigerated air containers. So there's traces like this all around us all the time in cities.
Connected world for sure, but what makes it neoliberal?
Well, we started, you know, the deregulation of air travel itself in 1978. So it's interesting that global air travel is itself one of the foundational conditions of neoliberalism, making air travel accessible and cheap and driving down prices, leading to the rise of the Gulf carriers and their labor practices and, you know, exploiting special economic zones and the deregulation of markets. But, you know, also just the notion of chasing constant global efficiencies and profits and ever lower prices. I mean, you know, the iPhone is a miracle of technology, but it's accessible to all of us, a supercomputer in our pockets, because of how Apple ruthlessly parceled out manufacturing, moved it offshore out of the United States away from union labor, where it could have cheaper prices in China and closer access to its supply chain.
At the food and flour level, you maybe want to rush to a farmer's market, but what is the price of all this, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's multifold, obviously. I mean, there's, of course, an environmental price we pay. There is, of course, the crisis of labor, and garments, of course, are moving to Ethiopia. I know Ivanka Trump's production is moving to Ethiopia for shoes. Transitioning a bit, when I think of cities, I mean, I've spent most of my time recently writing about Uber, and, you know, Uber is neoliberal to the extreme in terms of, you know, forcing a pool of exploited, underappreciated labor, putting them on an app and sort of trapping them on it and driving down the prices consistently. I mean, you know, Uber is a miracle if you are if you're the person using it, this dirt cheap private car for yourself with none of the messiness of owning a car. But, you know, for the labor, it's been terrible. So I guess my point is that the platform itself is new in terms of how Uber could massively scale up. I mean, I think I read somewhere that it's the third largest employer on the planet if they were actually employees, but the exploitation is still the same.
Introduce us to these aerotropolis and the war of airports. I've got one, you don't. The cities at war with each other, with what effect on the citizens, the school kids, the families?
Yeah, you know, the word aerotropolis, of course, it's a counterfeit Greek word. It's a Chinese samizdat word. Rem Koolhaas, the architect, used it in one of his books where he was talking about the fact that, you know, we once built public infrastructure as a way of supporting people and a supporting society, and now cities build competing infrastructures trying to destroy each other in various trade wars. You know, that's been the whole legacy of the last 25 years. You know, Dubai and the Gulf cities and China building airports or ports or special economic zones to flow hot money through them and become, you know, sort of the epicenter of the world. So, you know, the aerotropolis itself starts, you know, we could trace part of its DNA through, you know, the rise of airports and the construction of airports in the 70s and 80s. And another one of its threads, of course, goes through the special economic zones, you know, created by China with Shenzhen in 1979, and then reached their sort of fullest flowering in the last, you know, 15 years or so, where, you know, you have technocrats in, you know, in the Gulf, in China, realizing that, you know, you can't just build an airport. You know, you should try to build a complete infrastructure of warehouses and factories and just-in-time commerce to, you know, steal pieces of those global supply chains where you can. And that's, of course, exactly what Dubai has done with tourism and with a handful of industries through its port and airport complex, becoming the Gulf center of money laundering and housing and all those things. And then China, of course, has done it very successfully with keeping the electronic supply chains located in its cities. And so what's happening in China right now, for example, is, you know, they once built iPhones and computers and factories along the coast in Shanghai and Hong Kong, and now that's being relocated into the interior and entirely new built cities and zones to employ people there.
Greg Lindsay, what about cities we know, like Boston, which turned itself inside out, reimagining itself for the Olympics, decided not to go, but then did very much the same to attract the GE worldwide headquarters. What's that doing?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the GE headquarters sort of pursues a different variation of the model, right? The so-called innovation district that's been championed by Brookings and others, which is, you know, build a new collection of glass buildings and relocate innovation firms into them. And then, you know, patents will ensue. And of course, you know, it's interesting. They're both the Aerotropolis and the innovation district are both sort of cargo cults in a way, in the sense of, you know, trying to replicate urban form and then, you know, hoping that this magical practice will come from it. And, you know, and there's cities across the United States that are pursuing that model. Seattle, for example, is carving out a large chunk of its downtown for Amazon and South Lake Union. You know, we can look at what Chicago is doing by attracting McDonald's back and carving out whole areas as startup lands. You know, the whole urban tech phenomenon in San Francisco and in parts of New York, this sort of gentrification of the office district by technology firms. And, you know, and the irony there is, like, you know, at least in New York where I live, is, you know, you're seeing a displacement of the actual garment district, a naturally occurring high employment area, is being displaced now by tech firms that actually have few numbers of employees but are particularly sexy and, you know, attract huge amounts of venture capital.
Greg, if we could see exactly who's winning and who's losing in this transformation, could we, would we deflect the trend?
That's an interesting question. Who's winning and who's losing? Well, I mean, obviously the same people are winning now in the city. I mean, there's this talk about the great inversion, right? For years, cities the dense core of cities lost population. And the interesting part is they're still losing population, but now they're attracting, you know, white, wealthy homeowners back into cities. And of course, a handful of places like New York and others are, you know, reaping the benefits of global capital that are buying empty apartments. So, you know, I mean, obviously the city itself is winning. I mean, New York is getting some income out of this, but it's leading to the displacement of its own citizens. And I'm not sure, you know, filling our cores of our cities with empty buildings is a viable long-term strategy. I mean, London is about to find out what happens when Brexit is completed. And, you know, that's no longer useful to the owners of those buildings. And the mass displacement of housing from the city center. So, you know, yeah, I mean, the immediate loser is, of course, the people who live in these cities.
Fast-talking Greg Vinci is a two-time Jeopardy winner, the only human being who is undefeated at the game by IBM's Watson. Maura Weigel joins us from San Francisco. She just got her Yale PhD in comparative literature, all the while she was researching and writing her wry, historically informed book on 21st century courtship and dating, titled Labor of Love. Welcome, Moira.
Hi.
The Bay Area is the belly of the neoliberal beast. Girl, I hope you feel safe out there.
Yeah, well, they're keeping the bellies flat at SoulCycle out here, so everyone looks good. But, you know, it is ground zero of the neoliberal revolution in many ways.
The center, not least, of the friendship industry, living, liking, I should say, as a profit center on Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we think about, you know, I've been listening to Corey Robin and Greg Lindsay, and when we think about what neoliberalism is, one of the main things it does is create markets where there are no markets before, you know, to treat things that used to be social goods or things held in common as commodities and create revenue-generating markets in them. And friendship is a prime example. I mean, the idea that, you know, now our Facebook friends are the basis of a multi-billion dollar business every year, not for us, but for Facebook shareholders and for Mark Zuckerberg. So absolutely. San Francisco, we see sort of the enclosure of things that used to not be thought of as economic, which is very much
neoliberal. We're going to talk someday, not tonight, but about whether we really needed that friendship industry and all the billions going to thumbs up. But there's another point for starters. Moira, you are part of a new website because you're seeing high tech anew since the election of Donald Trump. How so?
Well, so our magazine is called Logic. It's about technology. It's actually a magazine rather than just a website. But I think Donald Trump is an interesting case. And in one respect, he's like the apotheosis of neoliberalism, right? Because if neoliberalism believes that everything should be a business and that everything is best run as a business, what could be more neoliberal than a failed businessman who plays a businessman on TV being elected president of the United States in order to reap vast profits from controlling the machinery of the state? He's sort of the ultimate. At the same time, I think he represents a turn towards something even scarier than neoliberalism, a certain kind of neo-fascism. But we could discuss that on another episode, maybe.
But what's the new light on neoliberalism and high tech itself? All these invented markets.
Well, I think, you know, there are many different angles. Two things that stick out to me are, you know, the thing we were just talking about in terms of inventing markets where there were none. So earlier today, I was talking to my sister who works in the city and lives here too, and was joking that she now sometimes moonlights with an app called Rover, which is an Uber for dog sitting. People will send her a message saying, oh, we need someone to watch our dog.
We
watch our
dog for 2 hours.
But, you know, a dog, which used to be, you'd think of as part of the home or a source of pleasure, and now there's this whole market and people around San Francisco will watch your dog. That's a comic example. But so one thing, you know, whether it's...
Who's going to watch the dog watchers?
I know. I watch my sister. Don't worry. But, you know, we have things like Facebook or things like, you know, Fitbit or period trackers. Companies have found ways to get people, you know, to literally the steps you take, which are measured by your iPhone automatically, are a source of data sets that are hugely valuable to Fitbit or to Apple. There was a controversy last spring, I want to say, because Glow, Max Levchin's period tracking app, where women would enter data about their menstrual cycles, was revealed to be non-secure, and that data was hacked. And there are all sorts of implications to that. So these things, I think this is one key feature of neoliberalism. It's not just about our overtly economic lives. It's that these most intimate aspects of our lives are transformed into markets. The other thing
we're going to get to some of the intimate parts, but I want to stand by, Moira, for Yarden Katz, who's with us in the studio. He's an uncommonly self-aware scientist, postdoc fellow in systems biology at Harvard Medical School, also a fellow at the Berkman Center on the Internet. And he writes about the complexity of commercial and human motives that drive cutting-edge science and medicine in our neighborhood. Welcome, Yarden. I never thought of our hot sciences in genetic and medical technology as neoliberal. But what does it mean? Is it all about money? Finding things to build rich empires on?
So I think of neoliberalism as an attack on our ability to build collectives and to engage in collective endeavors. And science is a collective endeavor. It's mainly funded by the state, and it depends on cooperation between scientists around the globe. And so, of course, science is not going to be immune to this neoliberal ideology. So you can see it really in almost every domain of science. One is the publishing system that we have, which is entirely privatized and closes off the knowledge that we produce to the public. And the second aspect is the sort of rise of intellectual property in science. So this craze to patent every scientific discovery in order to raise private venture capital and start a company.
Should we worry about that? The patenting of life-saving devices, theories, operations?
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of buzz in the news about CRISPR, which is this genome editing technology that has the promise of potentially treating many diseases by editing mutations in our genome that cause the disease. And CRISPR was developed through decades of publicly funded work. And there was a very ugly battle for the patent over it between MIT and Berkeley. And MIT won.
East Coast seems to have won that round.
East Coast won so far, right? It's still ongoing. And so basically this whole idea of editing our genomes with CRISPR is monopolized by one institute. And the use of that technology for therapies, for trying to cure many diseases from immune diseases to neurodegenerative diseases, it was given exclusively to one startup company that was started by one professor at MIT. So here you see kind of exactly a neoliberal move, which is you take something that was a collective built by many scientists around the globe, not just in the U.S., built by a collective through decades, converted into a private monopoly. And this is very bad for science. It's also bad for the public because no single startup can ever cure all of these diseases using CRISPR.
Yeah, but follow the line there. CRISPR, which could eliminate Tay-Sachs, for example, and nobody would really argue about that, but can also cure baldness maybe someday or nearsightedness or something on a list of, I mean, it's getting close to that inventing something to make money on that nobody ever thought was...
Well, I think it's problematic to say that it was invented. I mean, it's a system that existed in a microbe that we hijacked, and it turned out to have something useful for us. But that's done through, again, collective work, collective research. So it's not as simple to say it's an invention. It's part of nature, a system that exists in nature that we can then employ. So the deep question
is simply whose interest is being served by research at that level?
Well, I think that whatever you think of patents in general, we can agree that a university taking a patent on a broad area and then licensing it exclusively to one company does not serve the needs of science and does not serve the public.
With great battalions of lawyers and investors hovering around to see...
Millions in litigation, yes.
Millions in litigation, billions in profits down the line. I don't know. It's completely confounding to a civilian, but probably to scientists too. What's the right course? Who should be deciding these things and against what measure?
Absolutely. So I think scientists are generally you know, if I were in a pessimistic mood, I'd say complicit about it. They've essentially bought the narrative that patents are required for innovation, they're required for raising venture capital, and this is sort of the rhetoric that we hear now in the scientific community. To be a successful scientist is to be an entrepreneurial one, one that generates research that attracts investors and is lucrative for startup companies, et cetera. It's very much the Silicon Valley mentality that Moira referred to.
But short form, is neoliberal capitalism immune to moral questions, the largest social and human questions about where science ought to be going?
Well, I think of neoliberalism as anti-moral in a sense. I mean, it erases certain social values that we might care about upholding, one of those being diversity, for example. So in science, it's important to have diversity of viewpoints and also diversity in the identity of the people engaged in science. But we have a deep problem with diversity in academia in general, and particularly in the sciences. It doesn't represent a wide swath of society. So if you're trained to think in terms of market logic, you will displace other values that are very important, such as
diversity. And we're not talking gender or complexion. We're talking profound philosophical understanding and of history and who we are, right?
Well, I think those are related. I think the identity, gender yes. identity and the race identity will inevitably affect the diversity of viewpoints.
We're trying to pin the tail on neoliberalism this hour, largely because people listened to recent programs and said, but you haven't even defined it yet. We're trying to do it tonight. Coming up, one very strong-minded woman's take on what neoliberalism, by its very nature, does to feminism. This is Open Source. Something there is about neoliberalism that it can enter any space you could name for a profit and oftentimes compromise it. Some say cheapen it. Yasmin Nair is a writer based in Chicago who sees just that happening in the parade of celebrities now mass marketing their version of feminism.
Neoliberal feminism is a feminism that is defined by a particular class of women who already have enormous privilege and who see the issues with feminism as being mostly representational. So for them, it's important that there be more women on boards. So the best example of that, and I'm trying not to laugh, is the example of the woman who essentially paid for the statue of that little girl standing in defiance of the Wall Street bull. Neoliberal feminism works on the notion that what we need are more women in capitalism, what we need are more women in television shows, we need more women to be represented equally as, you know, heroes or whatever. But it has absolutely nothing to say about fundamentally destabilizing and smashing the systems that actually create oppressive conditions for everyone. You know, it doesn't really help to have a very diverse corporate law firm, for instance, where women are able to have, you know, diaper-changing stations in marble-lined bathrooms if the people, women and men, anyone else, who are responsible for cleaning those bathrooms have no access to childcare, are extraordinarily and strenuously overworked, and are underpaid. So the problem with neoliberal feminism is that it tends to assume that what we need is inclusion. It has absolutely no critique of capitalism itself. It also tends to see it very much on the axis of gender alone, which is to say, feminism is about women. I argue simply that feminism is about an anti-capitalist agenda, and it has to be about considering the situations of everyone who has been oppressed by patriarchy and capitalism.
Who are your poster people, Yasmin, of neoliberal feminism?
Lena Dunham. You know, Lena Dunham's feminism is very much about echoing the same rhetoric of inclusion, you know, and constantly also criticizing systems for not including more people, as opposed to saying what is wrong with the system.
I have been so shaken by this election. Mm-hmm. It has unveiled the darkest aspects of American culture, and the racist, homophobic, ableist, and xenophobic rhetoric is making me ill. Mm-hmm. So what do you think I'm gonna do with all this energy and all this rage? What I ultimately decided on was that the medium for me to express my anger was rapt music. Hey, hey, guys, it's MC Pantsuit. My hobby is rap music, but my passion? Defending the nation's baddest grandmother. I'm talking Hillary Rodham Clinton.
One of the things that is a real problem right now with neoliberal feminism is its emphasis on celebrities driving feminism forward.
Arianna Huffington.
Arianna Huffington. She's an arch capitalist who uses this neoliberal idea that all you need to do is make yourself feel better when you feel sick, and that will help you move forward. And of course, she offers all these paid for services, which will help you feel much better. So in her book about sleep, she's very much all about sleep these days. It's a big topic for her.
My big idea is a very, very small idea that can unlock billions of big ideas that are at the moment dormant inside us. And my little idea that will do that is sleep.
Now, Huffington's idea is that if you get more sleep, your businesses, your corporation, your bosses will benefit because you're rested and you're a much better worker. As opposed to, it is capitalism that is brutally exploiting us to the extent that we can't sleep. But we have no sleep, Arianna. So all your candles and your exquisite 400 count sheets and so on are not going to help if people like you are fostering work conditions that exploit people's labor and cause them sleeplessness in the first place. What I think I see developing more recently is this idea that to be a feminist, you have to be this kind of visible, popular, sexy, celebrity-style feminist. I find that a matter of great concern because the issues that feminism should be concerned with, those are issues that have a lot of resonance in the lives of people who don't want to be, are never going to be visible. So I think there's a kind of sexiness that feminism is becoming imbued with. And I find that very problematic because for me, you know, changing the world is a profoundly unsexy act, and I'm fine with that.
Yes, but there are people even who listen to our program who say, what is this neoliberal thing? Have I met it? Do I know it? Did somebody invent it? Where do we look for it?
Well, I would say to someone, if you have children, where does your child go to school? That's what I would ask them. And then I would say, okay, why did you choose that particular school? And the answer, I suspect, inevitably would be either I had no choice or I actually changed my neighborhood so that my kid could get into a better public school, right? Or my child is in a private school. And that right there, I would say, is severe privatization. You're not living in a country where every child has access to an excellent education. You're in a country where you have to move neighborhoods in order to ensure that you have a decent education. Is this fiction of choice that neoliberalism offers, when in fact what neoliberalism has done to you is to privatize something as essential as education? And you could go down the line and you could say, you know, why are you drinking from that bottle of water? Why is it that, you know, you live in a country which is the richest country in the world, where you can't be sure that you won't die from drinking your water, or that your child will not grow up with too much lead in his or her system? I do think that neoliberalism as a concept and as a word does circulate much more. But I would agree that, yeah, you know, maybe it's not quite the case that everyone gets a grasp of it. But I think that if we on the left start to situate the analysis and the definition of neoliberalism in the ways in which people are compelled to live their lives in ways that they think they choose, I think it can become much clearer. It is something that surrounds all of us. It is an inevitability of life.
And why do feminists have to know about it and deal with it in particular? Mothers, as you say, of school children, but in general, what does this add to feminist critique of the world and our politics?
So I think feminism has to become much more attuned to economic and political problems rather than, are women feeling better under capitalism? For that reason, for me, even the emphasis on pay scale, while it's extremely important, and I bloody well, you know, fight every day to make sure I get paid as much as my male writers, but there has to be a focus even beyond that, which is beyond pay parity, how do we ensure that the world works in a just way for everyone?
Yasmin Nair writes about pretty much everything from Chicago. Moira Weigel in San Francisco watches just about everything with a Yale PhD in literature. Yarden Katz in our studio is a bioscientist who watches genetic sciences at Harvard Medical School. Moira, back to you. Bring neoliberalism into intimate life, dating, sex, who we are.
Sure. Well, I wanted to jump in because listening to Yarden and listening to Yasmin and everyone pretty much, I think that something that's really important to emphasize is that there's this fiction that has become so naturalized that we hardly notice it, that this neoliberal account of reality is just real and this is the efficient free market and the losers are just losers and too bad for them. And I think that it's really important to stress that what neoliberalism is the privatization of collective goods. So with what Yasmin was talking about, for instance, you know, we could talk about this with childcare, with reproduction itself, with the raising of children. These activities increase GDP in measurable ways. Mm. People grow up and go into the workforce. That labor that women do is valuable. It is not an expression of reality that it's not valued. That's an effect of power. And I would say with the internet, I mean, the internet was built 100%, you know, by the government and the army, and was handed, you know, the keys to the internet were handed over to private companies in the 1990s, basically for nothing. Mm. So this fiction that, you know, Peter Thiel or Elon Musk or someone, you know, that has somehow value, or the Uber guy, Travis, whatever his name is, that value has like sprung unadulterated from their minds and just too bad for all those losers out there. It's a fiction and it's a power grab. They're making use of public infrastructures that were built using public funds that have been privatized. And you look at Uber, if I can just say one more thing, you look at Uber, Uber loses $2 billion a year. It loses $2 billion a year that is subsidized by venture capital, which is there because of Wall Street. I mean, it's not natural. And I think that's really important to emphasize.
But think about the moral questions. You heard Yarden say there's something amoral, maybe anti-moral about neoliberalism. How does that apply to not just sexual morality, but family morality, loyalty, intimate morality, the morality of private life?
Yeah, well, I think there's so many ways to, it's a great question. There's so many ways to think about it. Out here in San Francisco, I sort of joke, we're at the, you know, the birthplace of, one of the birthplaces of free love and a certain kind of free market thinking, and those two overlap, not coincidentally. I think this rhetoric that that everyone, you know, everyone's out for themselves, everyone's an individual actor, there are no social contracts that you can depend upon, which means that everyone is sort of free to negotiate sexually with everyone else however they want. There's a certain way in which I think that idea has sort of theoretically been mainstreamed. Of course, in a society where there's knock on wood anyway, very unclear how well people have access to contraception, abortion, not to mention how the burdens of, you know, childbirth, child care are distributed. Women and men will never are not encountering each other as free actors on this.
Who's going to rescue
market?
All that from the market is my puzzle. But I want to ask Yarden, Arianna Huffington, arch capitalist. That's media's problem in a way. But are there arch capitalists in the science and medicine world that we ought to know about too? Have we ever heard of a great scientist who was an arch capitalist?
Well, I think there is a kind of arch-capitalism in science, which is about this endless self-improvement and this idea that we can quantify and measure everything about ourselves and fix it. So if you have any sort of problem now with our ability to read and write the genetic code, we'll be able to fix it and we'll be able to control our genomes, manipulate our bodies, augment our cognition, and this kind of techno-utopian rhetoric is very dangerous because, again, it makes social and political problems of coordination that should be at the forefront, it makes them seem passé. So if you, for example, talking about climate change, you know, getting countries to agree on a solution together and working together, that's passé, that's political, that's inefficient. It'd be much better if we can develop technologies to colonize Mars, for example. So I think there is an arch capitalist or arch neoliberalism that is occurring in science, and that's the rhetoric of it, this endless technological improvement and a techno-utopian solution to every problem.
Do you want to apply that to healthcare?
Yeah, I think it's extremely dangerous in the case of healthcare because we like to talk about precision medicine as something that will be individualized and be tailored to us, and that seems superficially like a good thing. But first of all, that's only going to be for the rich who can afford these cutting-edge tools. And also the flip side for healthcare is that will be it's another tool of surveillance, of a way to measure our parameters, our biological parameters, and try to predict, especially now with machine learning and big data, predict who will get sick and when and how. And that will inevitably create a kind of rigged market that is favored towards
the
rich.
And I'd welcome your thought on this too, Moira, but take the ultimate sort of nightmare of CRISPR research, the ability down the road sometime, maybe another century, but to create, to bifurcate the species, sort of class A humans and class B humans, or which we have already in a practical way. But who can you imagine intervening against the market to say, no, we're not going there, or we're going there in a hurry, or who would bring the a non-market moral judgment, and how, Yardin?
Well, I want to just clarify one point about market. I think that there's a tendency to conflate free market with neoliberalism, and I think that neoliberals are actually not always in favor of privatizing things and of creating free markets. In fact, neoliberals rely, as Moira said, rely on the state, rely on public infrastructure, but they subvert it for their own needs. So, for example, neoliberalism needs a strong state to enforce neoliberal trade agreements. I think it's very careful not to sort of naturalize this idea of a free market, which doesn't really exist. It's a kind of rigged market.
Moira, I wonder, post-Trump, can we imagine a people's backlash here?
I think we're seeing a people's backlash here, and I think the terms of it will be, are yet to be worked out. I think a lot of Rosa Luxemburg socialism or barbarism these days. We know who's winning, but not for long, hopefully. But I think there will certainly be a backlash. I think this study came out of Harvard a year or so ago that, 51% of people from 18 to 30, not of Democrats, but of all people in that age category, say that capitalism isn't working and that they think socialism would be better. I mean, that's astonishing. Mm-hmm. I remember during the Democratic primaries when I think it was one of the first ones, there was this debate over capitalism versus socialism where Clinton had to come out and say, I'm a progressive who gets things done or whatever it was. But mm-hmm. I think that at least to me, that seems extraordinary and unprecedented in my lifetime that we're having those kinds of conversations. And frankly, I think the structural and material factors that are driving those changes are not going anywhere. Male unemployment among millennials is 29%. Where I live, workers, white collar tech workers who make 100 to 150K a year, if they have a lot of student debt, if they have kids, they're totally strapped financially, which sounds crazy maybe in cities with other real estate patterns. But I think that the forces that are pushing this reconsideration of neoliberalism or of its self-evident logic, I don't think those are going anywhere. So I think there's a conversation we'll keep having.
Can you imagine, Yardin, a moral as well as economic backlash? What it would look like, sound like, where it might be debated?
Well, so I think that whenever there is neoliberalism and neoliberal structures, there's also a counterculture and counter ways of doing things and spaces that occur in various cracks in the system. And so we should acknowledge that these exist everywhere. So if the university is getting more corporatized and more neoliberal with privatization of labor, with tuition costs rising, there are still places within the university that do provide refuge for people, and where you can think differently, and where you can imagine a different future. So I think,
where are those places? For example, quickly at MIT, say, or Harvard.
Well, I wouldn't look to MIT necessarily, but I'm thinking of Stefano Harney and Fred Moten's work on the undercommons and on the university providing an alternative place for thought in spite of its corporate neoliberal structure.
So many questions unresolved after a one-hour parsing of neoliberalism, which I thought I knew something about. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Yardane Katz. Thank you, Maura Weigel, Greg Lindsay, Corey Robin, and Yasmin Nair. And hats off to the hungry commenters on our website who suggested this show. Special thanks to Bill Dresiewicz for his wisdom on neoliberalism and the arts, of which more later. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden.